But now I'd like to open up for questions for John. So, Gary, would you like to make a start? No, you're going to have to yell.
Can you hear me? John, what's your... That's a very, very good overview. Thank you very much. What is your view? The policy
progress, if you like, has been driven by Victoria... and it's been driven under the guise of national reform agenda. What's your assessment of that in terms of delivering some of the reforms that you say are needed? And what are the limitations of that?
I think you're quite right that the Victorian reform has been driven by the Victorian Premier's department and the new Premier. Is certainly way ahead of anything else that I've seen in the country. But unfortunately, that agenda has not been picked up either by the federal government or the federal opposition. I think that my impression was that the Victorian government, and perhaps they had a political objective in mind, hoped that Mark Latham would pick up, or his shadow ministry would pick up, major elements of the health reform that they proposed. But he didn't. Particularly in education, and he went down another track on education, which we all know about. So I think there are limits in what a federal government or what a state government can do if the federal government and the shadow federal party cabinet is not active. My own view is that the immediate possibility is the negotiation of the next Commonwealth State Health Agreement. And certainly, as I've mentioned in more detail in my paper, I would certainly like to see an important element, or some important elements of that, would first be a drive to for the funding of primary health care across the country. In our paper, we suggested the Commonwealth Government should provide $4 billion, I think we said over 10 years, to roll out 200 primary health care clinics across the country. Some of that could be done through the present healthcare, through the new healthcare agreement. So that should, I think, be fleshed out. The second is that the Commonwealth Government should make it clear to the states that there is no more money for health unless there's significant workforce reform. It is absolutely disgraceful, health workforce reform in this country. Everyone else is copping the need for it, except for the health professionals and the lawyers. It is the most serious workforce problem we have in the country. But no minister anywhere has gone within cooey of addressing it. So I think those are two issues which should be at the forefront of the renegotiation of the Commonwealth State Health Agreement. It has to be, I think, done collaboratively between the two. That's where the political pressure should come to bear. And where the details can be fleshed out amongst professionals and bureaucrats, as long as they're given proper political guidance.
The second of those issues is one that we also have to address, the health workforce reform. We do have a position on health workforce reform, but what we haven't discussed is the issues that John has raised around demarcation. Obviously, we do have a broad membership here, and there are some thorny issues for us to look at, and again, I think that's something that we do need to do tomorrow. You mentioned the Commonwealth State Housing, Commonwealth State Funding Agreement. That's one of the reasons that led us to do the very small-scale consumer research that Tony McBride has led for us, is that we had heard that there was plans by the Commonwealth to put into place some sort of agreement that actually specifies performance standards for the states, and the states would be required to meet these standards to be funded. And we thought it was important that the community had input into those standards. So do we have another question for John?
I should mention, if I remember, the Commonwealth State issue, as I mentioned briefly, this proposal, what I've called a coalition of the willing, for joint funding, for the pooling of Commonwealth and state funds on a state-by-state basis, with agreed governance arrangements, provision if there is a dispute between the two, some proposals whereby there are dispute resolution arrangements, the coverage of a joint Commonwealth-state agreement by states. I believe there'd be a substantial opportunity to drive reform on a state-by-state basis. My own view is that it's unlikely that all the states will agree with the Commonwealth to establish a joint Commonwealth-state
health agreement across this commission across the whole country. I just think politically that's not on, but it is possible, I think, politically to do it on a state-by-state basis, and hopefully once it demonstrated its success in one state, other states would follow. It's not as good as a nationwide system, but I think it's probably the only way to proceed given the politics of this fairly diverse country.
Just a question, John, about the recent initiatives around Medicare, where we've seen funding for mental health services and allied health services through Medicare, and what seems to be happening through the data is that in fact that seems to be shifting government funding into the wealthier areas rather than into the areas that most need it. So because the workforce, the money follows the workforce chooses to work in areas where they want to live, which is not always those areas of highest need. So in fact, seeing a distortion of public funding away from high need areas, the areas that Medicare was designed to support, into the wealthier suburbs. One other comment about the 200 primary healthcare centres across Australia. I think a focus on buildings is probably not the solution to developing integrated primary healthcare teams. The elements for integrated primary healthcare teams are already there. It's a matter of developing a system that allows us to pull that together. I think buildings are a very secondary issue.
John, just before you respond, can I ask the speaker to identify himself, please?
I'm Rod Wilson from the Victoria Medicare Action Group and CEO of the Inroads Community Health Service, Victoria.
Thank you.
I think it's, I would partly agree. Obviously, you don't want to put capital expenditure if there are existing facilities that can be appropriately renovated and changed. But certainly the advice that I've received, I guess it was mainly from South Australia, who are with their GP Plus programs, they say to me that these have really got to be built specifically. If you're going to include a range of 20-odd specialties in a system, that it needs to be very customer-friendly. It must be built specifically as a healthcare, community healthcare facility, and that just grabbing an existing building makes that. In small country areas, in association with the hospitals, that is probably sensible, but I would think for serving big population areas, I'm not sure that existing facilities would be appropriate. On the question of funding, I think it's quite right, is that the funding drives what happens with else in the system. Medicare, I think, is a great funding scheme. And what it does, though, is it takes the existing delivery system as given and then funds that delivery system. What is it? The problem is the delivery system. And that's where the fundamental reform is needed. We must stop an arrangement whereby just the money follows and funds an incompetent, structurally bad delivery system. If we had an efficient delivery system, then Medicare would be funding an efficient system. But at the present time, in my view, it is funding an inefficient and inequitable delivery system.
Yeah, great.
From the Healthcare Consumers Association. I just wonder if you could tease out the role of the private sector in both primary healthcare service delivery and in the acute care sector. You talked about removing the subsidies for private health insurers to keep propping up that private system, but surely we've got this mixed system now. We've got to work with it. How can we make it work for us? How can we encourage private healthcare providers to actually meet some of the outcome objectives that you're talking about?
As far as in primary healthcare, in the paper that we have on our site, which Jennifer Doggett has developed, we envisage that most of the primary healthcare clinics would in fact be privately run. The governance would be not fully private, but there'd be probably a mix of local government, of state government, but it would be very substantially privately run. Governance would be in the hands of the private sector, subject to government guidelines. In many cases, those clinics would be operated through divisions of general practice in the local area, subject, of course, to government guidelines. Whether it be fee-for-service or salary services would vary from place to place. So I think we are fairly flexible, mainly because we don't know all the answers at that stage, but I would certainly see, given the nature of primary care in Australia, that there would be a very significant role for the private sector in it, subject to government guidelines, very clear government guidelines, and community involvement. In terms of other question in, I think it was in terms of hospitals, was it, sorry?
Acute care funding.
I think once again we have to accept the facts of political life, that private hospitals are here to stay, and I see no reason why they can't continue to perform a very important service for the community. The question is, where is the better value of money from the public dollar? In delivery of services through public hospitals or private hospitals? In most cases, I think it will be public hospitals. But if private hospitals can deliver a better quality service than their public counterparts, why shouldn't they be funded? I know there are all sorts of ethical and philosophical problems with some of them, but I think that's a minor issue. Where is the best value for the public dollar? And if it is the private hospitals, I personally can't see a problem with it, subject again to government guidelines being complied with. And as I mentioned before, if I think the big issue is a monopoly, frankly, of public insurance, public health insurance. I think that's the central issue, and not to get diverted into public and private in the delivery of care. Who delivers care more efficiently and effectively than others? That, I think, is the central issue. And as I mentioned, private hospitals in Australia would be at least $1 billion better off if government money was delivered to private hospitals on a per capita or a DGR basis, rather than via these dreadfully incompetent private health insurance companies who administratively are just escalating costs. It is an appalling system, private health insurance, but it is getting government subsidies, it's not really being appropriately tested. I would much prefer to see governments paying money direct to private hospitals on appropriate conditions, rather than channeling it through these private health insurance funds who just absorb so much of it in overheads.
And that's a very important distinction for us to recall as well, the difference between the private health insurance sector and the private health delivery sector. I believe we had a question over here.
Hi John, it's Fiona Tito-Wheatland. I have had a long and strong interest in relation to quality and safety in healthcare. But one of the other things, the more I've delved into it, is that you've got not only mistakes being made in healthcare, but also significant amounts of healthcare that should be being delivered not being delivered, and significant amounts of healthcare that's known to have no benefit continuing to be delivered. It seems to me at a national level, in terms of both preventing adverse events and also ensuring quality, we need to have some better mechanisms, if you like, for making sure that the care that is useless isn't funded, and care that is beneficial is provided. I'm wondering if you've had any thoughts about how we might achieve that, given the reluctance of most providers to report a lot of that sort of data.
I agree. The central issue, again, is leadership. Both the professionals and the bureaucracies and the ministers involved in this issue want to hide it. They don't. It's bad news. You know, it's happening in one hospital one week, and then a month it's Bundaberg or it's Campbelltown or somewhere else. And their objective is to keep it out of the newspapers. And they don't address the fundamental problems of it. And that is, I think, a critical issue. There are particular issues of registration of hospitals. Some hospitals should be closed. They're dangerous, but they're kept open for political reasons. A lot of clinical services should be amalgamated because they can't be sustained on a wide basis at the present time. As accreditation that I mentioned, there are major governance problems. I've written several articles. The first article was, who runs hospitals? I've come to the conclusion that no one runs hospitals. That there is a discontinuity between corporate governance and clinical governance, and there is no effective unity whereby these sorts of issues are addressed. There is a major cultural problem.
whereby people are blamed and victimised. The last thing you want, if you're going to fix safety problems, is to keep it secret. Keep it out of the way. You must get it out into, if not the public arena, at least into the area where it can be addressed. That's what airlines do. And I've had some experience in airlines, that people are not victimised if they bring safety problems to the surface. Firm action is taken, but they are not victimised, so people are encouraged to come forward. That doesn't happen in health. People get, particularly junior staff, really get stuck and victimised, and we've seen it time and time again. So there are a whole range of issues, but the governments deal with the symptoms. They don't deal with the fundamental issue. They want to keep it covered up. And that's, again, I think, a question of leadership.
Another question?
Margaret Atkin from the Parliamentary Committee, House of Representatives Parliamentary Committee on Health and Ageing. I'm just wondering, you were talking about the political will, and are you actually, in fact, saying you need the leadership to be coming from the Prime Minister, in fact? Or are you talking in terms of stronger leadership from the health minister himself?
All of that. I think there is a lack of political resolution by state health ministers, state premiers, the federal minister for health, and the prime minister. I think where we see political resolution by ministers, prime ministers and premiers, we get results. But we have not seen it in health. They are very much and too responsive to the best interest in the system, and that's what we have to break open, to bring to the public through public debate, public engagement, involving treasuries, other departments, that this is not a matter any longer that can be corralled within the health ministry. This has serious consequences across the whole economy and the whole of society, and we need more players, powerful players, in to produce the reform. It won't come from health ministers.
Another question?
Can anyone prove otherwise? I haven't yet seen it.
Well, I think that's proof of your argument in itself, isn't it? Fiona?
Just a quick question. Fiona Armstrong from the Australian Nursing Federation. John, I just wanted to query your advocacy of the fee-for-service system continuing.
Could you speak up a bit, sorry?
I was just wanting to query your advocacy of the fee-for-service system continuing in the multidisciplinary primary healthcare centres that you advocate, given what we know about the limitations of the fee-for-service system in terms of its issues around perverse incentives and the incentive to provide more services, not necessarily better services. And I also wanted to ask about what your position was on the privatisation or the private ownership of those primary healthcare centres in light of Tom Carmer's advocacy of community-controlled health services for Indigenous communities.
Okay. On the first point of in the primary healthcare clinics of fee for service and salary, I guess I'm being have to be politically realistic that fee for service will be an important part of that. I personally hope over a period it would decline significantly. I believe that if we are going to address some of those so-called work shortages in general practitioners, we'll need to bring in substantial numbers of mainly women working part-time, who will probably only respond to salary. That I think that's been that we have the feminisation of the workforce. It has occurred, and these primary healthcare clinics would attract, I believe, part-time women with families back into the workforce. And I think salary will probably be the principal way that they will do it. And I would hope, I certainly am a strong believer of salary staff. I think it does provide better long-term services. And some services can only be delivered that way. A lot of mental health services, a lot of Aboriginal health care, drug services can really only be provided effectively, you might believe, by salary. Fee-for-service doesn't attract people to that sort of work, unfortunately. On the question of community control, I spent quite a number of years in immigration, and I'm personally very strongly of the view that mainstream services must be available to all. And whilst in the short term, this may sound unhelpful, but in the short term, special arrangements for communities, Indigenous communities or others, can only be justified if the mainstream service is not providing non-discriminatory care for all. My worry is with specialised services, mainstream services say, well, that's the problem for Aboriginal health care. It's not our problem. And that happens. I've been in Port Augusta, and I know that happens up there, that the mainstream says, well, that's Aboriginal health. You go down and see them, and they opt out of responsibility. In the short term, I believe that that is necessary, to have specialised services, but they can only be justified so long as the mainstream services are not providing non-discriminatory services. But in the longer term, the mainstream services have got to be reformed. And that, I think, is the central issue, to serve everyone.
Okay, we've got time for about two more questions. Jeff, over here.
Thanks. Gordon Renouf from Choice. A couple of questions about private health insurance, John. The first is a relatively unimportant question about just your comments on Medibank's recent initiatives in relation to trying to do cost control with hospitals. You said that PHI was always price takers, but they seem to, at least at the surface, be trying not to be only a price taker. So that's the first question. The bigger question, though, is about you accept the political realities in relation to maintaining a partially fee-for-service model and in dealing with one state at a time rather than a national model. But I wonder in the short and perhaps medium term that private health insurance in some form, or the subsidy rather, in some form, is a politically too difficult thing as well. Joshua Gans, for example, argues that he actually sees some merit in private health insurance, but he doesn't like the percentage rebate. He thinks we should have a flat fee rebate because that at least would give some pressure in favour of the lower cost provider. So the broad question then is really the political realities in relation to the private health insurance rebate, that $4 billion, $6 billion saving that you're proposing.
I'm sure that the reason why it is not being addressed by the opposition is just for that purpose. It's a political calculation. I think that's unfortunate. If I was a shadow minister and there was $18 billion in the next parliament that wouldn't be applied to private health insurance but to other areas of dental health, prevention, primary health care clinics, I think I'd be a pretty poor politician if I couldn't make a strong case for it. The cookie jar is full with money. Not cookies, but money. And it could be, I think, politically very attractive to spend that money in other ways which would overcome some of the political downside that you've mentioned. At the very least, it should be capped. At the very least, it should be capped as a political measure so that the situation won't continue to deteriorate. The United States, I mentioned briefly, is facing this problem. In the war years, because of wage controls, Roosevelt couldn't agree to wage increases. So the unions negotiated with their employers to provide private health insurance, General Motors and all the big ones. And that's how private health insurance developed in the United Kingdom. And now they're scrambling like hell to get out of it. It's a disaster for them. Private health insurance inevitably leads to escalating costs. Some private health insurance funds attempt to moderate cost increases by negotiating caps or reduction, but very few do. They are weak price takers in the market. They're afraid what the other private health insurance fund will do if they attempt to put a cap on hospital fees, procedures, and visits to the surgery. The only one in Australia that can really bargain from a position of strength is Medicare. And it should be allowed to do it. If people want private health insurance, well, that's fine. I've got private health insurance, but I see no absolutely reason why I should get a government subsidy for doing it.
Okay, one final question.
Karen Negri from the Department of Premier and Cabinet in Victoria. Just a quick question, John. Your presentation has been fabulous. And I'm very interested in how we do get health reform on the national agenda, given there seems to be a lot of interest in keeping it off the national agenda. You mentioned the Romanow Commission that took place in Canada, and I'm wondering whether that is the way to go for Australia, and if that's the case, how do we get impetus for this idea? Where does it have to come from? Who's the national player who has to put this idea of a major public consultation and a major debate on addressing some of these intractable issues?
I think it can, but well, I think we can't excuse the state governments, and I acknowledged before, I think the Victorian government is well ahead of any other state in what it's been doing in this area. And if the state government of Victoria was prepared to say to the next federal government, we are prepared to establish a Commonwealth State Health Commission in this state to drive healthcare, joint funding, governance, coverage, that would be a very substantial way, because I think an important role of that state federal commission would be public education. Information, the public has to be informed, because the monopoly of information is very largely with the existing suppliers of suppliers in the industry, doctors, pharmaceutical companies, and so on. So I think the state government can do something, but at the federal level, which is of course what the Romanow Royal Commission was in Canada, clearly requires a federal response. And I would have thought that either government, or probably more likely the opposition, to propose that would be, I think, an important way forward. I know there is always the criticism that governments or the oppositions only propose royal commissions or inquiries when they really don't know what to do. In this case, I think an argument can be strongly made that it's a way of engaging the community, and I think the critics could be handled and managed so that we could set up a Romanow-type ongoing commission or inquiry in Australia to put out into the public realm some of these sorts of issues that I've been mentioning, but a lot of others as well. We must stop this arrangement whereby the debate is between doctors and ministers. If that continues, we will not get reform. We need transparency, openness, other players into the debate. It would be lovely to get a Prime Minister or a Health Minister who would show leadership. But short of that, I think we could build the case for significant change along these lines. Once there's an informed community, I think the whole political question changes. And my experience is when the community is informed, and it's only been on a micro basis where I've seen it, it has very clear views about the need for change. Mental health, Indigenous health, always at the top of the list. And I believe if we had a national inquiry which drew out the information, put it on the public record, the public would pretty likely come to the same conclusion.
Well, that provides us with a very, very handy segue to our next speaker indeed, John. Thank you. Thank you for your very, very compelling case in favour of the need for leadership in this area, in favour of public insurance, in favour of primary care centres, and of moving the debate away from health and into Treasury, and also your arguments in favour of workforce reform. These are all issues that we really do need to consider here today. I'd like to invite you to stay on the stage while Tony speaks.